Airline Pilot Guy, episode number 84. Hello, you're listening to the Airline Pilot Guy Show, the view from my side of the cockpit door. I'm Captain Jeff, your host, broadcasting live from Studio 520 in the Crown Plaza Hotel in Greenville, South Carolina. In this episode, turbulence, open cargo doors, landing gear malfunctions, first flights of a couple different airplanes, lots of your feedback, questions, and much more. So, get all settled in, tray tables and seat backs in their upright and locked positions, electronic devices powered on. Flight 84 is ready for pushback. And hello, and welcome back to the Airline Pilot Guy Show. I'm, as I said, in Greenville. Just recorded episode 83 a few days ago, and it's Tuesday, day two of a three-day trip. And honestly, right now, I should not be recording this show. I should be studying because I have training on Thursday and Friday. And I'm a procrastinator, and I'll do anything to keep from doing what I really should be doing, and which is studying. I really haven't prepared much at all. So I plan on making this a short episode. So we'll see how that works. But let's get on with... let's do some news stuff. Southwest Airlines flight takes off with the door wide open. Can you believe it? I can't. Here's the ABC News article. On your next flight, should you look out the window and make sure your plane's door is closed before the flight leaves? Well, you actually should, but that's beside the point here. ABC News reports that a Southwest flight from Houston to Dallas took off with a cargo door open. An eyewitness at the airport told ABC News, quote, "I couldn't believe my eyes. I couldn't believe a plane as sophisticated as they are would take off with the cargo door open." A representative from Southwest Airlines told ABC News that an indicator light came on right after takeoff, and the captain landed the plane in order to have the door checked out. Luckily, no one was injured. Okay, so number one, you've heard me talk about my experience with a cargo door open, and we didn't have an indicator light in the front that told us that the door was open. A passenger, you know, got the attention of a flight attendant before we took off in Nassau, and sure enough, the door was open, but we didn't take off. But we did listen to, I don't know if you can hear that or not, but I can, and my room is perfectly situated here, right next to the elevators and the ice machine. Score, I got them both, guys and gals. Ice machine and elevator. Yay! I didn't think we were supposed to be close to either of these two things. I thought that was part of our contract. But who am I? Who am I to say anything? So, I did turn off the air conditioning unit here in the room to keep from all that air noise in the background. It's starting to warm up in here, but hey, I'm making the sacrifice for you, because that's just who I am. I'm suspect about this story. I think that they probably took off. They probably got an indicator light that said that the cargo door was open, or what that means is not fully closed, or perhaps it was just a switch that malfunctioned and was out of rig or whatever, and out of an abundance of caution, came back and landed to check it out. I have a feeling that this eyewitness, I haven't been able to confirm this anywhere else on the doing my research on the internet, that the door was indeed open. I think that it was some witness that heard about the story and thought, oh, yeah, I saw it. It was wide open. I don't know. Maybe it really was. I don't know. But anyway, another example of how the media tends to blow things out of proportion. Like, for instance, here, let me go over here to something I just received today, in fact, from Matthew in Australia, in Brisbane, as a matter of fact. And he said, I've attached an article of an incident that occurred here today in Brisbane. This is actually an aircraft I do ground handling for. Glad to see that everything ended without tragedy. And then I clicked on the article, and basically it was a flight by, well, let's see, I don't have the, I'm afraid if I click on the link here that it's going to cause all kinds of Wi-Fi noise, which you're probably hearing right now. I should probably turn off my Wi-Fi antenna. Let's see if that helps. And this is probably something you can't even hear, but I hear it, and I'm very sensitive about my sound quality. Okay. Anyway, it was an airline flight, a BA-146, that had a gear indication, a problem with a gear that was not correct. They probably raised the gear handle, and there was some kind of a light that showed maybe a door out of sequence or an unsafe indication some way. Not really unsafe, because when you're raising the gear, it's not really considered safe or unsafe. It's when you lower the gear and you don't have a, you know, down and locked indication. That's when you might have an unsafe indication. But they ran through their checklist procedures, I'm sure, and decided to, you know, lower the landing gear, which is what we would do if that happened. And it's happened to me before on the MD-88, where something gets a little out of sequence, the doors opening, closing, that kind of thing, and the hydraulics all operating. And you usually, if you put the landing gear handle back down and you get good indications, then you say, you know what, this is good, we'll go with this, we'll keep what we have, and return to the origination airport and land and let the mechanics take a look at it. And in fact, in the article, the CEO of the airline was quoted as saying that he was kind of surprised that emergency services were responded to this incident, because he said, you know, the pilots didn't declare an emergency. So, again, maybe out of an abundance of caution, the local airport services decided to go ahead and roll the emergency equipment, even though an emergency was not declared. And they probably had perfectly fine, safe landing gear indications once they lowered the landing gear handle. But, again, another incident of stuff getting blown out of proportion. But that's just what happens in and aviation and the media. Let me go back to something here. I meant to, you can tell that didn't do a heck of a, I normally don't do a lot of preparation for the show, but I've done even less than I normally do, because I wanted to get this episode out before I go to training later this week, and I probably will not have an opportunity to record another episode until next week when I'm on a 4-day trip. And I didn't want the feedback to pile up even more. So I want to do something, and I'm going to play something, and you're going to think, wow, Jeff, what are you doing? You're going to get in trouble. Well, here I go. And this is the Ink Spots singing Java Jive.
I love coffee. I love tea. I love the Java Jive, and it loves me. Coffee and tea and the Java and me. A cup, a cup, a cup, a cup, a cup.
All right, bringing that back down. Now, you may wonder, are you asking for trouble, Jeff? What's wrong with you? Well, you know, I mentioned that I'd had a couple strikes for copyright infringement. Actually, what I had was something, I think, less critical than that. It was something that flagged content, content ID, not even a violation, but and there's a little checkbox that I have to check in there that says that I've acknowledged that I used content that doesn't b- belong to me. And now I've argued that the Ink Spots recording that I just played, that was in 1940. And where I got that clip was a public domain site. So I just assumed that it was safe to play. So I don't think I'm really in as much trouble as I thought I was. And somebody, and I'm sorry, I don't remember who, sent me a comment or a message, or it may have been a YouTube comment. I don't recall. But they said, you know, if you play something like that and you basically give credit for who it was and that kind of thing, you're okay. So we're going to try it. This was Java Jive, recorded in 1940 by the Ink Spots. So we'll see what happens. And speaking of the coffee fund, if you want to support the show and support my addiction to coffee, you can contribute by clicking that little button on my website that says Buy Me a Cup of Coffee. And thank you again to everyone who has done that. Between just a couple of days ago and the recording right now, I haven't had any new donations, but that's okay. You guys have been very generous. I love you. Thank you very much for all your support. And I sent out a bunch of email thank yous to many of my coffee fund donators to thank them all for their contribution. So again, here's to you. I don't have a coffee cup. Somebody mentioned that they noticed in the video that I had a coffee cup that had Acme Airlines, the logo, on it. And he said, you know, I'd buy one of those if you sell them. So I don't know. Would you be interested in buying a coffee mug with Acme Airlines logo on it, or perhaps a T-shirt, something like that? Let me know, and we'll see what we can come up with in my spare time. As you may know or may not know, I also do a little bit of a really little bit of printing of T-shirts and coffee mugs in my spare time, because I really don't have any spare time anymore, but I do have that capability. So let us move on with feedback. No, more news. Let's see what's going on here. Well, a couple of things regarding first flights. Yesterday, I believe, Bombardier Corporation flew their first C-Series jet, the CS-100, in Montreal. And it looks, I don't know all the specs on the airplane, but I'm assuming from the name CS-100 that it's a 100-seat or 100-passenger airplane. It looks very much like the Embraer 190 series, or maybe a 737. You know, it's a wing-mounted engine, twin engine with the winglets, blended winglets, and a nice-looking airplane. Bombardier's entry, I guess, into the that's not really their only entry. They've been flying Canadian regional jets for a long time, but it's their first entry into this class, I guess, or this size of airplane. So congratulations to Bombardier for their successful flight yesterday. Leave some ice for me, please. The other thing, I believe today, Tuesday, the first flight of the 787-900 model is to take place. So maybe right now as I'm talking, it's up there flying for the first time. So we have that. And then I saw this. Auburn University Aviation receives FAA flight time exemption. Now, you've heard me mention in previous episodes that, you know, well, first of all, I'm a graduate of Auburn University, the aviation management program. And I thought that they were going to lose their aviation management program, or at least the professional flight option portion of that. And then I read something more recently that said that it looks like they are going to be keeping the program. Apparently, they did lose accreditation from one of the accreditation services or whatever. But this article says that Auburn University's aviation program became the sixth in the nation to receive FAA exemption, creating a lower required flight time requirement for aviation graduates. Aviation students in the Raymond J. Harbert College of Business are now eligible to earn an airline transport pilot certification with as few as 1,000 flying hours instead of the typically required 1,500. Dale Watson, director of flight education at Auburn, said that this is an opportunity for graduates of either the aviation management program, which is the program that I was in, or the professional flight management program. So apparently they still have that program there. Can be hired sooner than they would without the exemption. Let's see, what else do we want to talk about here in the article? We are only the sixth college in the nation to be given this authority. What they are doing is authorizing the colleges to certify certain graduates for reduced hours credit. We are now authorized to do that. So great, congratulations, Auburn, War Eagle, and looks like the aviation program is not dead yet. I'm not dead yet. All right. Well, that's enough of that. Let's go over here to some feedback that I was kind of in the middle of on the last episode before I ended it. And it was from a Reader's Digest article and news.com.au regarding 13 secrets airline pilots won't tell you. And let me see if I can find my place. Yeah, I think right here. Some FAA rules don't make sense to us either. Like the fact that when we're at 39,000 feet going 400 miles an hour, a plane that could hit turbulence at any minute, flight attendants can walk around and serve hot coffee and Chateaubriand. I doubt that. But now they're doing construction in the hotel here, so I hear a jackhammer now. Ah, it never ends. It's either a jackhammer, ice machine, elevator, or in my last episode at home, some of you picked up on my bird upstairs chirping, Cedric, my cockatiel. Okay, so I'm going to pretend I don't hear that construction going on. So, the flight attendants can walk around back there 39,000 feet going 400 miles an hour with hot coffee, but when they're on the ground on a flat piece of asphalt going 5 to 10 miles per hour, they've got to be buckled in like they're at NASCAR. And that's from Jack Stephan, or Stephen, U.S. Airways captain based in Annapolis. Let's see. This is a quote from Joe Dion, who used to have a podcast. And as far as I can tell, the last thing he put out there was back in 2010, May of 2010, and looks like he's given up on the podcasting gig. But his show is really, really good. It was called Come or Just Fly With Me. Joe Dion, if you want to do a search for his podcast, that's Joe D apostrophe E-O-N. And he is also a pilot for Acme Airlines. And, oh, by the way, when I was doing my research to see if Joe was still doing his show or doing something in new media, I watched his last or part of the last live Ustream recording he did. And guess who I saw? Guess who was a special guest via video Skype on his show? Yes, PJ Gustafson. Sorry, PJ. In Houston, he was on his show. I guess he was trying to get support for some kind of a raffle. But way to go, PJ. You looked good. That's the first time I've seen you, by the way. And you sounded great, looked great. And that was on Jodion's Fly With Me live podcast, Ustream. Anyway, back to this article. Joe is quoted as saying, "The two worst airports for us, Reagan National in Washington and John Wayne in Orange County, you're flying by the seat of your pants trying to get in." Oh, I'm sorry. No, that wasn't his quote. That was somebody else, a pilot in South Carolina. This is Joe's quote. "At some airports with really short runways, you're not going to have a smooth landing no matter how good we are. John Wayne Airport, Jackson Hole, Wyoming, Chicago Midway, and Reagan National." Now, I have had some good landings at Washington National. I've been in there many, many times. I've also had some bad ones. I've never flown into John Wayne, nor Jackson Hole, nor Chicago Midway. I go into O'Hare all the time, but I've not been to Midway. So, let's see. I may be in uniform, but that doesn't mean that I'm the best person to ask for directions in the airport. We're in so many airports that we usually have no idea. And that's a common thing. And it's understandable. You know, you're walking around. Obviously, it looks like you belong in the airport because you have a pilot uniform on. And people assume that you know your way around the airport. Now, if somebody was asking me a question about something in the Atlanta airport, I'd be familiar with it. But there are a lot of places that we go. I have no idea, you know, where anything is or whatever. And then the other thing that I'm not really, really very sure about is even in Atlanta, when somebody asks me where the Sky Lounge or the special, you know, the special place that frequent flyer multi-million milers go, those lounges, you know what I'm talking about, where they are. And I said, well, because they don't want us to hang out in those places because there's usually alcohol. You know, it's just not good for our image. They kind of discourage us from going to those places. So I don't know where they are. I know they seem like they're everywhere, but that is kind of funny, though. People will ask us questions about, you know, things specific to a certain airport. And as this pilot for a regional carrier in Charlotte, North Carolina said, we usually have no idea. Oh, this is a good one. Jack, Stephen, again. This happens all the time. We'll be in Pittsburgh going to Philly, and there will be a weather delay. The weather in Pittsburgh is beautiful. Then I'll hear passengers saying, you know, I just called my friend in Philly, and it's beautiful there too. Like there's some kind of conspiracy or something. But in the airspace between Pittsburgh and Philly, there's a huge thunderstorm, and that's the reason for the delay. And yeah, I've had this all the time. You know, you're sitting at in Boston, it's a beautiful day. Atlanta, nice weather. I just talked to my wife. She said it's picnic weather. Why are we having a weather delay? Well, because our route of flight is going to take us right through New York Center and Washington Center, and they have thunderstorms wall to wall. They don't have any room for us. That's why. But to most people, it doesn't make any sense. So we do our best to explain it, though, right? You may go to an airline website and buy a ticket, pull up to its desk at the curb, and get into or onto an airplane that has a similar name painted on it. But half the time, you're really on a regional airline. The regionals aren't held to the same safety standards as the majors. Now, this is from a captain at a major airline, and I don't know if I would agree with that. They are held to the same safety standards as the major airlines. Now, he goes on to say, their pilots aren't required to have as much training and experience, and the public doesn't know that. Well, I mean, half of what he's saying is correct. The part about the fact that when you buy a ticket on United and you show up to the airport and you get into an airplane that has United Express painted on it, you're assuming it's United Airlines, and all the announcements that they're doing on the airplane are talking about United, but when it really gets down to it, this is not United Airlines at all. It's one of the regional carriers that United has contracted with to do this flying for them. And it's a two-edged sword. I understand why the airline wants everybody to think that that is part of their airline because it's all one seamless experience, right? The downside is that when something goes wrong on one of those regional airlines, like has some kind of an accident or incident, or you know, some flight attendant gets into it with one of the passengers, and it's a negative thing, negative PR for the airline, well, then everybody thinks it's the parent airline, the major airline, that you know, did the wrong thing, and it's kind of hard to straighten that out and say, well, no, that wasn't United, that was Masaba or Chautauqua or, you know, one of the other airlines that may do flying for them. So it's like you can't have your cake and eat it too. You either have to suck it up and understand that you're going to get blamed for things sometimes that really wasn't something you should be blamed for. But on the other hand, you get the benefit of people thinking that you're on their airline from point A to point B to point C to point D. You get the picture. All right. Another quote from Jodian. Most of the time, how you land is a good indicator of a pilot's skill. So if you want to say something nice to a pilot as you're getting off the plane, say, "Nice landing. We do appreciate that." Yeah. We do. It's nice to hear, if we do have a nice landing, to say "nice landing." Something to, you know, appreciate what we do, because we really do try hard to give you the best experience that we can. On the other hand, I was on a flight last week, deadheading home, last flight of my trip. I was supposed to fly, my co-pilot and I were supposed to fly it. The training captain came off, I think I mentioned this in the last episode, and said, we're doing an initial operating experience. We'd like to fly this back to Atlanta so we can complete all the training. Would you mind, you know, sitting in the back, deadheading? And so we said, yeah, no problem. You know, if we can help out somebody, we'll do that. I was very, very disappointed that there was no communication between the cockpit and the passengers. Zip, none, with the exception of a very, very short quip right before, not a quip, but a short little PA right before takeoff. Flight attendants, prepare the cabin for takeoff. Okay, that was it. Flight attendants, prepare the cabin for takeoff. Five words. We get up to cruise altitude, nothing. We're starting our descent, nothing. I don't know. I don't think that. And this was a Czech airman is up there training another captain. I'm sorry. Our policy says that we're supposed to communicate with our passengers at a very, very minimum level, at least. And that didn't even happen at all. I'm not very happy with the fact. Now, see, if I had flown that airplane, if we had done that flight, operated that flight from Detroit to Atlanta, the passengers would have gotten a lot of information. Now, don't worry, I'm not the guy that talks the whole flight or that every 5 minutes gets on there and says, "This is the Chillahooka River," or whatever. But I will come on as we're either in the latter stages of our climb or at cruise altitude and say, "Hey, we're up at cruise altitude. I'm turning off the seatbelt light." I do a little spiel about the seatbelt and the fact that you should stay in your seat at all times with your seatbelt fastened unless you need to get up to go to the bathroom or something. Something important, a legitimate reason to get out of your seat. Otherwise, sit down, keep your seatbelt on, because you never know. We never know when we might hit turbulence that wasn't forecast. That the autopilot may just all of a sudden decide to do something funky. You never know. So it's better safe, it's better for you to be safe and seated with your seatbelt fastened at all times. And then I say something about our routing. I mean, we don't have one of those moving map displays on the airplane that I fly. So a lot of people are interested in knowing where we're going to be flying over. When we're going to get there. We're in the air now. We have a pretty good idea now when we're going to land. Either we're going to be early, we're going to be on time, we might be a few minutes late. Hey, what's the weather like where you're going, you know, where we're going? So I give all that information, and then I shut up. And then as we begin our descent, or right before we start our descent, I say, "Hey, thanks for flying with us. A nice, gracious thank you. Hope you enjoy the flight. This is our gate that we're going to, and update on the weather, etc." That's just stuff I think that most passengers want to hear. And to not say a peep the entire time, I don't know. In my opinion, it's unacceptable. So just thought I'd put in my 2 cents about that. All right. And the last thing in this article says, no, it's not your imagination. Airlines really have adjusted their flight arrival time so that they can have a better record of on-time arrivals. So they might say a flight takes 2 hours when it really takes an hour and 45 minutes. And that was from an AirTran Airways captain in Atlanta. Now, I must kind of correct what that person said. The reason why they publish a certain departure time and arrival time that is always or almost always going to be longer than the actual flying time, is that you have to take in consideration how long it's going to take to get out from the gate to the runway and then from landing to the gate. And they have historical data to know when there is going to be an extended delay taxiing out for takeoff. And yeah, sometimes they'll want to pad it a little bit, because the Department of Transportation here in the U.S. does keep track of those perennially the flights that are always late, and they don't want to draw the attention of the Department of Transportation, so they'll sometimes pad it a little bit. But I think one of the problems is, and I was standing in the gatehouse the other day, and one of the gate agents said, flying time today from Atlanta to Dallas is 2 hours or an hour and a half, when no, the flying time was actually 1 hour and 15 minutes. I'm just making this up. I don't know what flight it was that we were flying, but she basically said the flying time was the block time, the block out to block in time. And then I had to say, when I did my announcement, that, well, actually the flying time today, regardless of what you heard out there, is not 2 hours. It's actually 1.5 hours, because, again, we have time at the front and time at the back. Flying time is the actual time we take off and land, but there's some other time to put in there somewhere, right? So, and then you might ask, why is it that I did this flight last week and it was an hour and a half, and this week it's only an hour and 15 minutes? Well, because nature changes. The winds aren't always the same. So, when marketing comes up with these block-in, block-out, block-out to block-in times, or what we call block time, they have to kind of average it. And sometimes you may be well under that block time because the winds are really light or you have a really nice tailwind. And sometimes you may be the flying time may actually be longer than the block time because you have an unusually high headwind that you're having to fly into. You get the idea. So just be aware that whatever a gate agent tells you for your flying time may not really be your flying time. When a pilot says, you know, this is our flying time, well, then you can take that to the bank. At least that's the plan. All right, moving on. Airline pilots engaged on issue of unmanned aircraft. Let's see, who sent this to me? Oh, this is from First Officer Jeff, and he sent me this article from AIN Air Transport Perspective. 2 years out from the September 2015 deadline, the U.S. Congress established to introduce unmanned aircraft systems into the nation's airspace system. Airline pilots are engaged in the process of developing standards and practices that UAS operators will follow. And so this is an article about the fact that there are many of us airline pilots who are concerned about mixing it up with unmanned aircraft systems or unmanned aircraft vehicles or whatever you want to call them, drones up there. And apparently this is all going to happen, and there are going to be thousands of these things flying in the air in the next few years. And we want to be part of the rulemaking to make sure that they stay out of our way, so we're not running into these things, or they're running into us and causing a problem. So thanks, Jeff, for that article. This is from Pasadena Brian. He says, I know you always say to wear your seatbelt, and here are two more examples of why. If I recall correctly, you talked about severe turbulence on a past episode, but I can't remember if you've ever encountered any personally. In these days of advanced electronics, is there a good reason why modern aircraft should experience severe turbulence? Mr. Albright said that said about severe turbulence, it is extremely uncomfortable but not dangerous. Would you agree with the statement? Would you really say it's not dangerous? So that's from Pasadena Brian. No, I would not say that. I would say that severe turbulence can be dangerous if everyone isn't seated with their seatbelts fastened and everything isn't, buckled in or bolted down or secured. If everybody's seated and attached to the airplane and all the loose pieces are attached in some way to the airplane, a bout with severe turbulence doesn't necessarily have to be dangerous. But it can be. Severe turbulence can cause enough of a disruption that your airplane is momentarily out of control. Of course, some people would say, well, that's extreme turbulence. It used to be just light, moderate, and severe, and now we have light, moderate, severe, and extreme. So I think that an episode of extreme turbulence would definitely be dangerous and would be possibly the type of turbulence that actually could result in catastrophic structural damage to an airplane. And that's definitely dangerous. So let me read a little bit of this. And your question about, is there any good reason why modern aircraft should experience severe turbulence? Well, and you mentioned advanced electronics. Well, the problem is we don't have advanced electronics yet to be able to see clear air turbulence. Now, you can guess when you see a severe complex of thunderstorms that if you get too close to them or you're downwind of the storm system too close to that, that you can experience severe turbulence. But when you're flying up there and you don't have convective activity and you don't have reports from somebody who has just gone through that area, you don't know it's there. So we're not quite there yet. Now, I do remember a few episodes back, there was some kind of promising technology using laser light that can somehow sense when there is a disruption in the wind and in the atmosphere that could be associated with severe turbulence or moderate turbulence. And so I guess they're working on it, but we're not there yet. So we have to be extremely vigilant as airline pilots to know how weather works, how thunderstorms work, know how to avoid thunderstorm activity and deviate around it correctly, upwind or whatever. Stay away from it far enough so you don't experience the effects of the turbulent air around thunderstorm complexes. We have to, if we experience something, we have to be vigilant to make sure that everybody else knows that we're in some moderate to severe turbulence or even light turbulence. Help your fellow pilots out. Let somebody know. Don't be a secret squirrel and keep the information to yourself. Let air traffic control know. Say, hey, I have a PIREP, a pilot report. This location, this altitude, this is the turbulence we're experiencing. And then air traffic control needs to tell everybody else who will be flying through that area that that's what has been reported and that that's what they can expect. We have to be very vigilant to look at our meteorology reports, our turbulence plots and that kind of thing, to be forewarned about hazards that we may encounter. We can't just blow that off. We have to be, we just have to be paying attention. And if everybody's doing their job, then 99% of these turbulence encounters could be avoided. And again, I'll say to my fellow pilots, if you know you're going to get a bumpy ride or a rough ride, and you wouldn't want to be back there standing up in it, well then, let everybody know that it's coming, that everybody's seated, including your flight attendants. Okay, make sure that you tell your flight attendants to stay seated. And now, flight attendants, it's your responsibility that when the captain or the captain's representative calls, makes a PA or calls you on the interphone and tells you to sit down and put your seatbelt and harness on, that you do it. That you don't wait 15 or 20 minutes until you hit the turbulence and now you're an injury. So everybody has obligations and responsibility here. So thanks for the article Pasadena Brian. Let me see. I'll read a little bit of it here. Dozens of people have been injured after turbulence caused by tropical storm Kong Rei affected flights into Hong Kong. Thai Airways said 39 people were hurt when an Airbus A380 carrying 500 passengers from Bangkok to the Chinese city encountered the turbulence on Friday morning. The airline sales manager says both passengers and crew members suffered slight injuries as the plane was coming into land, adding that those hurt were sent to three hospitals in the surrounding area. Meanwhile, Hong Kong Airlines said three passengers and three flight attendants had been hurt when a flight from Phuket hit sudden turbulence as it neared the airport. The airline said the plane landed safely, and the six injured people have since left the hospital. So, if you're flying in an area with a tropical storm, you're very, very likely to hit turbulence. And so let's just be smart about it and be prepared for it. Avoid it if you can. If not, make sure that everybody's forewarned. And let's see. This is really interesting. This was sent to me by Jeff Harrison. And he said, I thought you may appreciate the story about the early navigation system in America. Pretty neat. And these arrows are still around in some places. And so he sent me this this article, which I'll hopefully include in the show notes, that has pictures of all these huge concrete arrows that were put out every, what did it say, every 10 miles, I think. Every so often, usually in the vast deserts of the American Southwest, a hiker or backpacker will run across something, a large concrete arrow as much as 70 feet in length, sitting in the middle of scrub, in the middle of nowhere. What are these giant arrows? They are the Transcontinental Airmail Route. On August 20th, 1920, the United States opened its first coast-to-coast airmail delivery route, just 60 years after the Pony Express closed up shop. At that time, there were no good aviation charts. Pilots had to eyeball their way across the country using landmarks. This meant that flying in bad weather was difficult, and night flying was just about impossible. The Postal Service solved the problem with the world's first ground-based civilian navigation system, a series of beacons, of lighted beacons that would extend from New York to San Francisco every 10 miles. Pilots would pass a bright yellow concrete arrow. Each arrow would be surmounted by a 51-foot-tall steel tower and lit by a million candle-power rotating beacon. And there was a generator shed at the tail of each of the arrows, which were powering the tower and the beacons. Now mail could get from the Atlantic to the Pacific, not in a matter of weeks, but in just 30 hours or so. Even the dumbest of airmail pilots, it seems, could follow a series of bright yellow arrows straight out of a Tex Avery cartoon. By 1924, just a year after Congress funded it, the line of giant concrete markers stretched from Rock Springs, Wyoming to Cleveland, Ohio. The next summer, it reached all the way to New York, and by 1929, it spanned the continent uninterrupted, the envy of postal systems worldwide. Advances in communications and navigation technology made the big arrows obsolete, and the Commerce Department decommissioned the beacons in the 1940s. The steel towers were torn down and went to the war effort. But the hundreds of arrows remain. Their yellow paint is gone. Their concrete cracks a little more with every winter frost, and no one crosses their path much, except for coyotes and tumbleweeds, but they're still out there. So that was a great article. Thank you, Jeff, for sending it. Very interesting. Okay. I'm on Facebook, Airline Pilot Guy, all one word, and several of you Follow me there and sometimes send me feedback there as well. And here's an example of some feedback that I receive, and I try to answer it all. I'm not always successful with that, but I do try to reply in Facebook or on Twitter or in the comment section of the website or even on the comments section of YouTube, my YouTube videos. Don't always get it done, but I really do try. And this is from Ben. Not sure where to post a question for the show, so forgive me if this is the wrong place. Hey, that's all right, Ben. This is a good place. Anyway, my question is fairly simple. It seems like some flights are smooth until you reach the cruising altitude, where you then encounter constant chop. I've been on some flights where it seems you hang out there until descent, and then it's smooth all the way back down. Is it a pain to ask for a new altitude that's smoother? Is it sometimes easier to just grin and bear it for 45 minutes rather than make changes to the flight plan? I've been on some flights where the pilot will announce they are going to seek smoother air, but then I've been on some where it just seems like it's smooth right up until cruising altitude, and you just ride along with the bumps until descent, usually on smallish planes like the MD-80 or 737. Thanks for putting on your show. Well, you're welcome, Ben, and that's a good question. And you know what is... there's an old saying that we say in my business, and it's the irony of it that is really makes us chuckle, that we'll be smooth all the way throughout our climb, and as you mentioned here, right before you level off and at level off, it's bumpy. And we usually say, oh, well, you can tell that we're approaching our cruise altitude because it's getting bumpy. And... that happens quite often, actually. And I'm one of the guys that will say to the passengers, I'm sorry, it's bumpy. We're working with air traffic control, other aircraft, to find a smooth altitude if possible. But in the meantime, please remain seated with your seatbelt fastened. And if we can find a lower altitude, that is a better ride, we'll do it. Now, sometimes it's not available because there may be, you know, there are all these airways in the skies, and you're at 34,000 feet, and there's opposing traffic at 33,000 feet, and you really need to get down to 32,000 or 30,000, but there are other airplanes going in the same direction you are along that same routing, and they're occupying that space. And now if it's really bad, we'll take an off-course vector to get separation from that traffic that may be right below us, so to get down to an altitude that is acceptable. But if it's not too bad, we'll just stay there until that slot becomes available below us, or above us, if that's the case. Sometimes we're flying along and all the smooth air is above us, but we're too heavy to get up to those altitudes, or the altitude's higher than the service ceiling on our airplane. Like my airplane, the highest we can go is 37,000 feet, because that's what the aircraft was certified for, and the pressurization system and all that kind of stuff. The airplane probably would get up higher than 37,000 feet, but we're not allowed to do that. It's not certified to do that. Sometimes you got to go all the way down to like 25,000 feet or below, but then you have to consider that when you're lower, you're burning a lot more fuel, and you may not have enough fuel on board because you hadn't planned this to make it all the way to the destination. So then you have to consider, is the ride so bad that we have to go down to the mid-20s or below, burn more gas, and, yeah, we're probably going to have to stop short of the destination and get more fuel and then continue on. That's one of those things. As a captain, you have to kind of weigh, you know, how bad is the ride? Is it so bad that I just have to get out of it no matter what? And if that means having to stop, then we need to do that. So there are a lot of variables. It's very dynamic. And then the bad ride may be have something to do with the altitude, but the bad ride may also be a location-based thing where all the rides are bad in all the jet altitudes in that area. So you might as well just stay where you are and stick it out. So what I do is I try to communicate to you, the passenger, that this is what's happening. This is what we're trying to do to fix this problem, to make it a better ride for you, to make it so where we can have our flight attendants up and serve beverages or meals or whatever. And then if I'm unsuccessful in finding a nice smooth ride for you, I will let you know that too. To let you know, to communicate that we really are trying, we're not blowing you off, we're not just saying that we're looking for a good ride and hoping that it's just going to smooth out and just stay where we are and so we can get on with whatever we're doing up there. No, I'm going to tell you that, well, unfortunately, this is the reason why we can't descend or climb, or this is the reason why it's a bad ride, and this is the reason why, you know, we're going to have to stay at our particular altitude, or even we've tried all these different altitudes. You probably heard the engines spooling up or you know, spooling down. You probably felt your ears pop a little bit because we're changing altitudes. We really are trying to find a better ride for you, and we just haven't been successful, and we apologize for that. But sometimes Mother Nature just is not cooperative, and that's about the only thing I can tell you, Ben, is that it's just sometimes hard to figure out. Again, a lot of this turbulence is invisible. You know, I wish we had glasses that we could put on and like X-ray vision, and we could actually look out the window and see where all the Now, I think one of these days, maybe that's something that will happen in the future. There will be some kind of device, for instance, that laser thing that I was talking about earlier, where we can actually have some kind of a way to see the turbulence ahead and go, oh, look, you know, it's as obvious as a thunderstorm. Oh, look, there's a big blob of thunderstorms. Let's, you know, descend or turn left or right to avoid that area of turbulence. But we're not there yet. Now, with the convective activity, we are. We have pretty good tools to help us see where the thunderstorms are, and we should have good education to let us know that, look, you need to stay at least this minimum distance from the storm, downwind of it or upwind of it, to avoid the effects of convective turbulence. But as far as the clear air turbulence, no, we don't have that capability yet. Again, we're relying upon other pilots reporting it, and air traffic control reporting it, and doing our best to get out of it. And sometimes we'll even use our own meteorology department at Acme Airlines. We have a full weather staff that we can access and use as a resource. And sometimes through talking with them on a phone patch will help us locate where the best ride may be. But so thanks again, Ben, for your feedback and listening to the show or watching it, whichever you do. And let's go over here to some of the comments from the Airline Pilot Guy website. Robert Carr just wrote a couple of days ago, great website and podcast. I just came across them and I'm enjoying them immensely. Thank you. He works as the director of music at the Cathedral, the Catholic Cathedral in Spokane, Washington. And I also own and fly a Cessna 182 and am interested in airline flying. I don't know if your airline flying would ever bring you to Spokane, but if so, please feel welcome to stop by the Cathedral for Mass and be sure to contact me. It would be great to meet you and talk further. Sincerely, Robert. Well, thanks, Robert, for listening, and that's great. You, too, seem to have the same passions that I have. Flying, music, and the same faith. That's cool. Used to fly out to Spokane a lot back in the old 727 days. That was a great airplane to fly pretty much everywhere in the United States. And so got into Spokane quite often, flying out of Salt Lake City into Spokane, Seattle, Portland, Pasco, and all kinds of cities out west. It was great. Great flying. And I really, really like Spokane. So if I'm ever out there again, I'll definitely look you up, sir. Thank you for your feedback. Carlos wrote, thank you for your reply regarding the intro song. He asked about my intro music and who did that. And he said, by the way, your singing performance was not bad at all. Thanks, Carlos. Appreciate that. Garrett writes, and by the way, Garrett has a website, mypilotchronicles.com. Check that out if you want to hear his podcast and read his blog. Again, mypilotchronicles.com. And he said, Jeff, great show, great singing. Thanks. And I mentioned a link, Life of an Airline Pilot, that one of my listeners sent. And I forgot to put the link in the show notes. So I sent him the link. And I will try to remember to put it in these show notes in case you are looking for it too. And so there you have it from Garrett. Again, check out his podcast and website. And that's, again, mypilotchronicles.com. John Morrison writes, he's a captain for FedEx. Recently found my podcasts on Stitcher Radio and find them entertaining on my Asia layovers. He said, one can stand only so many repetitions of CNN International or BBC World News. I have to agree with you about the new RNAV stars coming into Memphis. They were designed by a non-pilot in FedEx Air Traffic Control Services with optimization of flow for FedEx's inbound flights between 2300 and 0100 Central Time, a.k.a. Elvis Time. even then, we are frequently directed by Memphis Center and Memphis Approach to ignore the published speed restrictions on them by either going as fast as we can or as slow as we can. However, during daytime hours between 8 o'clock and 11 o'clock, the inbound flights from FedEx, ATC has us fly those RNAV stars as published, including the speed restrictions, which are really annoying in the MD-11, and we frequently have to extend the slats to comply with the 210-knot restrictions. Yeah, I don't... don't get me started, John. Yeah, JB. John. Let's see. Guess the ATC guys figured out by issuing a... quote, descend via the blank arrival north transition means they don't have to think and the onus is solely on the pilots. You got it. I also have to agree with your observation of there being very little traffic in the Memphis area during the day. It's been like that ever since a major airline cut its Memphis schedule from 240 flights a day to now under 60. Wow, big cut. Keep the widget side up, he says. Thank you, Captain J.B. Morrison at FedEx. Appreciate you listening. Hope this is entertaining for you on your Asia adventures. And I do appreciate you listening and sending me feedback. And as I mentioned in the last episode, that maybe I was a little bit harsh on some of these RNAV arrivals and transitions. But I don't know. I can't help but think that things worked so well before. And I think being lazy is another aspect of this thing. Evan writes, if you're looking for sources of music, one of the best that I know of is Jamendo, Jamendo.com. Be careful, though. The music is licensed through Creative Commons, and you can only use some of it for things like podcasting. Thanks, Evan. I'll check out Jamendo. Let's see. Ralph writes... I'm not going to try to pronounce your last name, Ralph. What kind of name is that? Okay, I'm going to spell it. N-G-A-B-O-Y-I-M-A-N-A. Wow. That's got to be impossible to pronounce. He says, I'm Ralph, and I'm 19 years old, currently a sophomore, attending Arizona State University, hoping to graduate with a degree in aeronautical management, professional flight. I'm doing my flight training through ATP, which coordinates its curriculum through our university degree program. My biggest concern at this point is funding. I know loans are going to be a reality, but if you have any advice on other avenues to pursue, that would be much appreciated. In addition, how long do you think it should take to get all the ratings besides the ATPL? Do you think your military experience gave you an edge over the other applicants when applying to become an airline pilot? Hopefully this is not a weird question, but I was just wondering if there are a lot of African-American pilots flying for your airline. I ask because I am African-American myself, and though I know it makes no difference in regards to the selection, hiring process. I really enjoy your podcast and find them very informative. I look forward to more videos and hearing back from you. Thanks. Okay, you're hearing back from me right now, Ralph, and yes, it does not make any difference in hiring and applying and selecting pilots. You know, the airlines are looking for qualifications. If you are, you know, a qualified applicant, you'll get hired regardless of your color, your race. Well, that's the same thing, isn't it? Your creed, your religious beliefs, whatever. It's a, you know, pretty wide open world out there, and you just have to have what they're looking for as far as, you know, basic requirements. And, you know, it doesn't hurt to be personable, be able to have a conversation, be the kind of person that they could picture standing at the cockpit door as people are leaving the airplane and saying, thank you for flying with us, have a nice day. So if that's what you are, you're good as gold. Now, you said or asked, how many African-American pilots do we have flying at my airline? Quite a few, actually. Now, of course, it's definitely a minority of our overall pilot force. And I can't really tell you exact numbers, like what percentage we have, but I would imagine it's similar. Well, actually, it's probably less than whatever the percentage of the national population is, because, you know, we're like a subset of the country as far as you know, what we do, our skills and all that kind of stuff. So but again, I don't really know how to answer it. I've flown with several African-American pilots. I've flown with several female pilots, and I would say that it's probably roughly the same percentage of both of those groups. They're just like everybody else. So I wouldn't worry about it. And I wish I could give you a better answer as far as the exact number or exact percentage of our pilot group, but I don't have that information. So good luck with your, and as far as ideas for funding, I wouldn't recommend playing the lotto because, you know, it's not a very good way to get any money. But you never know. Maybe you'll win something big. A rich uncle? Do you have a rich uncle? No. Loans, I think, are going to be it. And hopefully you won't incur too much loan debt and you'll be able to recover from the pile of debt sooner rather than later. I think that this upcoming pilot shortage will help. If you fly in the regional airlines, there's a good chance you won't have to fly for too many years at not appropriate wages before you get on with the majors. But I'm hoping that regional airlines pay will increase, and as well as the major airline pay increase here in the future because of supply and demand, and that you'll be able to pay back those loans sooner rather than later. And then all the money coming in will be you can use for whatever you want to use it for. So that's all I can say about that. Thanks, Ralph, for your feedback. I appreciate the listening, and don't hesitate to send me more feedback in the future. Kopa, Dasayo, Dasayo. I figure that if I pronounce it every way I know how to pronounce it, I'll get one of those will be right. You've yet to send me any audio feedback with you pronouncing your own name, so I challenge you. He says, he always sends me interesting comments, and he said, I've heard worse singing, Captain. Well, thank you. Appreciate that. Let's see. Daniel writes, just discovered your podcast. I've been listening for about 3 days, and I'm listening right now to a previous recording. I'm a private pilot finishing up my commercial right now, and I'm looking forward to a professional airline career. Listening to your podcast is just the thing I've been looking for. Next time you lay over in GSP, oh, that's where I am right now, I'd love to buy you a beer and chat more about it all. Happy landings, Daniel. Oh, and I'm getting a warning on my iPhone here that I'm using for the video that the storage is almost full. I'm right at a little over an hour, and I think I sent Daniel an email and let him know that I was here and that I was recording, and this might be a good time to just end the podcast and check my email, see if Daniel has returned my email. And there are several more comments that I want to read, but that'll just have to wait for a future episode. So remember, you too can send feedback by sending it to feedback@airlinepilotguy.com. The feedback line, 304-99-PILOT, or by recording something on your smartphone and attaching it to an email sent to feedback@airlinepilotguy.com. Stitcher Radio is a good place to listen to the show. iTunes, subscribe if you want. And thank you to all of you who have rated me, sent me good reviews on iTunes. I appreciate that. So other people can find out about the podcast and our Airline Pilot Guy community. And I'm sure I'm leaving out something. Yeah, I have a YouTube video at the same time, which is just me sitting here recording the show. Pretty boring, but if you want to see what it looks like when I'm doing this, check it out. And until next time, hey, wish me luck on my training in the next few days. And until next time, wishing you clear skies, unlimited visibility, and tailwinds. Take care, and God bless.